The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler over his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command. These words, spoken by the prophet Samuel, sealed the fate of a king. Before there were palaces, before there was a throne, before Israel had ever known the rule of a mortal king, God chose a man. Not a warrior, not a priest, not a prince, but a simple man searching for lost donkeys. The Spirit of the Almighty descended upon him, transforming him from a shepherd into a vessel of divine authority. Sacred oil ran down his head as the prophet declared, "The Lord has anointed you." But here lies the mystery that will haunt us. Why would the same God who chose Saul, who filled him with his spirit, who gave him victory after victory, why would this God turn his face away? Why would the anointing become a curse? The truth is terrifying. Proximity to God's power does not guarantee his presence. Anointing does not equal obedience. And when the creator of the universe says, "I regret that I made Saul king," kingdoms crumble, minds shatter, and destiny itself is rewritten. This is the prophecy fulfilled and the warning unheeded, the rise and fall of King Saul. Samuel was getting old. His sons, Joel and Abijah, were supposed to be judges over Israel, but they weren't like their father. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 3 tells us they turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes and twisted justice. The people saw this corruption and they weren't happy about it. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and went to Samuel at Ramah. They came to him with a demand. "Look, you're old now and your sons don't follow your ways. Give us a king to judge us like all the other nations have." This upset Samuel deeply. When they said, "Give us a king," it really bothered him. The thing displeased him. So he prayed to the Lord about it. And God said to Samuel, "Listen to what the people are saying to you. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me. They don't want me to reign over them anymore." God explained that this was nothing new. Since the day he brought them out of Egypt until now, they'd been doing the same thing, leaving him and serving other gods. "According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also," God said. "Now therefore listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." Samuel told the people everything the Lord had said. He warned them seriously about what having a king would really be like. "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you," Samuel said. "He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. Will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots." Samuel continued, "He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage, and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, and your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants." Then Samuel gave them the final warning, "And you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They said, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." Samuel heard all the words of the people and repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed their voice and make them a king." So Samuel said to the men of Israel, "Every man go to his city." The decision was made. Israel would have a king. There was a man from the tribe of Benjamin whose name was Kish. The Bible tells us in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1, that he was the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becherath, the son of Aphia, a Benjamite, a mighty man of power. This man Kish had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul, Verse 2 says, "There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people." But let's be clear about something. Saul wasn't royalty. He didn't come from a line of kings or priests. He wasn't a famous warrior whose name was known throughout the land. He was just a young man from Benjamin. And Benjamin was the smallest tribe in all of Israel. His father owned livestock and land. Saul's days were filled with ordinary things, helping his father manage the family property, taking care of animals, doing the regular work that needed to be done. Nothing in his background suggested anything special was coming his way. Yes, he was tall, very tall, and yes, he was handsome, but that was about it. There were no prophecies spoken over him when he was born, no dramatic signs in the sky, no special training in leadership or warfare, no preparation for greatness. He was simply Kish's son, living a normal life in the hill country, going about his daily routine, completely unaware that the God of Israel had already looked at him and chosen him to be the nation's first king. His life was ordinary, predictable, and unremarkable. Until the day his father's donkeys went missing. One day, the donkeys belonging to Kish, Saul's father, were lost. They had wandered off somewhere, and Kish needed them found. So Kish said to his son Saul, "Please take one of the servants with you, and arise, go and look for the donkeys." It was a simple task, find the missing animals and bring them home. So Saul took one of the servants, and they set out on their search. They passed through the mountains of Ephraim and through the land of Shalisha, but they didn't find them. Then they passed through the land of Shalim, and they were not there. After that, they passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they didn't find them there either. They searched and searched, going from region to region, but the donkeys were nowhere to be found. Days passed. When they came to the land of Zuph, Saul was getting worried. He said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us return, lest my father cease caring about the donkeys and become worried about us." It was a reasonable concern. They'd been gone for days now. At some point, his father would stop thinking about the lost donkeys and start worrying about his lost son instead. But the servant had a different idea. The servant said to him, "Look now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go." Saul thought about this suggestion, but there was a practical problem. Then Saul said to his servant, "But look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered Saul again and said, "Look, I have here at hand 1/4 of a shekel of silver. I will give that to the man of God to tell us our way." It wasn't much, but it was something they could offer. Saul agreed. In earlier times in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he would say, "Come, let us go to the seer," for the prophet of today was formerly called a seer. Then Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they were going up the hill to the city, they met some young women going out to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" The young women answered them and said, "Yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry now. For today he came to this city, because there is a sacrifice of the people today on the high place. As soon as you come into the city, you will surely find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now therefore, go up, for about this time you will find him." What Saul didn't know, what he couldn't possibly have known, was that this wasn't random at all. Every step he'd taken while searching for those lost donkeys had been guided. God was orchestrating this entire situation, bringing Saul to exactly the right place at exactly the right time. The donkeys were just the excuse. The real reason for this journey was something far bigger than Saul could imagine. The day before Saul arrived, something remarkable had happened. God had spoken to Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 9 verse 15 tells us exactly what God said. Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, "Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry has come to me." So Samuel was expecting someone. He knew a man from Benjamin would arrive, and he knew exactly what he was supposed to do when that man showed up. And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "There he is, the man of whom I spoke to you. This one shall reign over my people." Saul had no idea about any of this. He walked into town simply looking for directions to the seer's house. Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, "Please tell me, where is the seer's house?" Samuel answered Saul and said, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today. And tomorrow I will let you go and will tell you all that is in your heart. But as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on all your father's house?" This must have been shocking to Saul. This man knew about his donkeys. He knew they'd been lost 3 days ago. He knew they'd been found. And then he said something even more mysterious, something about the desire of all Israel being on Saul and his father's house. What did that mean? Saul was completely confused. And Saul answered and said, "Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me?" It was a legitimate question. Benjamin was the smallest tribe. Saul's family wasn't important or influential. There was nothing special about them. So why was this prophet talking to him this way? Samuel didn't answer the question directly. Instead, he did something that must have seemed very strange. Now Samuel took Saul and his servant and brought them into the hall and had them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited. There were about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the portion which I gave you, of which I said to you, set it aside." So the cook took up the thigh with its upper part and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, "See, what was kept back is set before you. Eat. For until this time it has been kept for you, since I said I invited the people." So Saul ate with Samuel that day, the place of honor, the best portion of meat reserved specifically for him. Samuel was treating Saul like someone important, like someone special. And Saul still didn't fully understand why. When they had come down from the high place into the city, Samuel spoke with Saul on the top of the house. They arose early, and it was about the dawning of the day that Samuel called to Saul on the top of the house, saying, "Get up, that I may send you on your way." And Saul arose, and both of them went outside, he and Samuel. The moment of revelation was coming. As they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, "Tell the servant to go on ahead of us." And he went on, "But you stand here a while, that I may announce to you the word of God." The servant walked ahead, leaving Samuel and Saul alone. Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him and said, "Is it not because the Lord has anointed you commander over his inheritance?" This was the moment. Everything changed in an instant. Sacred oil running down Saul's head. The prophet's kiss on his face. Words that marked him as chosen by God himself. Saul was no longer just a man searching for his father's donkeys. He was anointed. He was set apart. He was God's chosen leader over Israel. But Samuel knew this was a lot to take in. He knew Saul would need proof that this was real. So he gave him specific signs, things that would happen to confirm that this anointing was truly from God. "When you have departed from me today, you will find two men by Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. And they will say to you, 'The donkeys which you went to look for have been found. And now your father has ceased caring about the donkeys and is worrying about you, saying, what shall I do about my son?'" And that was the first sign. Specific people at a specific place would tell him specific information. Samuel continued, Then you shall go on forward from there and come to the terebinth tree of Tabor. There, three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you, one carrying three young goats, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a skin of wine. And they will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, which you shall receive from their hands. That was the second sign. Three men with specific items would meet him and give him bread. Then came the third and most important sign. After that, you shall come to the hill of God where the Philistine garrison is. And it will happen, when you have come there to the city, that you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with a stringed instrument, a tambourine, a flute, and a harp before them. And they will be prophesying. Then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you, and you will prophesy with them and be turned into another man. The Spirit of God would come upon him. He would prophesy. He would be transformed into a different person. Samuel gave him one final instruction. And let it be, when these signs come to you, that you do as the occasion demands. For God is with you. You shall go down before me to Gilgal. And surely I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait till I come to you and show you what you should do. So it was, when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, that God gave him another heart. And all those signs came to pass that day. Everything Samuel predicted happened exactly as he said it would. When they came there to the hill, there was a group of prophets to meet him, just as Samuel had said. Then the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. And it happened, when all who knew him formerly saw that he indeed prophesied among the prophets, that the people said to one another, "What is this that has come upon the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" This was shocking to everyone who knew Saul. He wasn't a prophet. He'd never shown any signs of being spiritually gifted like this. He was just Kish's son, the tall young man who helped his father with the livestock. And now he was prophesying alongside actual prophets? What had happened to him? Then a man from that place answered and said, "But who is their father?" This became a proverb that people would repeat, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" The saying captured the surprise everyone felt at seeing this transformation. When he had finished prophesying, he went to the high place. Then Saul's uncle said to him and his servant, "Where did you go?" It was a simple question. They'd been gone for days. Where had they been? So he said, "To look for the donkeys." When we saw that they were nowhere to be found, we went to Samuel. That was the truth as far as it went. But it wasn't the whole truth. And Saul's uncle said, "Tell me, please, what Samuel said to you." So Saul said to his uncle, "He told us plainly that the donkeys had been found, but about the matter of the kingdom, he told him nothing. Saul kept it secret. He'd been anointed king. He'd been transformed by the Spirit of God. He'd been given a mission and a calling. But he didn't tell anyone, not even his own uncle. He went back to his normal life, carrying this enormous secret inside him, waiting to see what God would do next. The anointing had happened in private. The public revelation was still to come. Then Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah. It was time for the public announcement. And he said to the children of Israel, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians, and from the hand of all kingdoms, and from those who oppressed you. But you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you from all your adversities and your tribulations. And you have said to him, 'No, set a king over us.' Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans." Samuel was reminding them that this king they wanted represented a rejection of God's direct rule. But God had agreed to give them what they asked for. Now it was time to reveal who that king would be. So Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. When he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was chosen. And Saul, the son of Kish, was chosen. The lots had fallen. The selection was complete. God had identified his choice through this sacred process. Saul, son of Kish, was to be Israel's king. But when they sought him, he could not be found. Where was he? This was his moment. The entire nation was gathered. The lots had chosen him, but Saul was missing. Therefore they inquired of the Lord further, "Has the man come here yet?" And the Lord answered, "There he is, hidden among the equipment, hidden among the baggage." In the moment when he should have stepped forward, Saul had hidden himself. Was it humility, fear, a sense of inadequacy? The text doesn't tell us his motivation, only his location. So they ran and brought him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. There he was, standing head and shoulders above everyone else. Physically, he looked exactly like what people expected a king to look like, tall, impressive, commanding. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen, that there is no one like him among all the people?" So all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king!" The people accepted him. They shouted their approval. Saul was now publicly recognized as Israel's first king. Then Samuel explained to the people the behavior of royalty and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. And Saul also went home to Gibeah, and valiant men went with him, whose hearts God had touched. God touched the hearts of certain men to follow Saul and support him. These would be the core of his supporters, the beginning of his administration. But some rebels said, "How can this man save us?" So they despised him and brought him no presents. But he held his peace. Not everyone was convinced. Some looked at Saul and saw nothing special. They despised him and refused to honor him with gifts. But Saul said nothing. He didn't defend himself. He didn't argue. He simply kept quiet and waited. He'd been anointed in private, proclaimed in public, but he hadn't yet proven himself as a leader. That test was coming soon. Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh Gilead. This was a crisis. An enemy army was besieging one of Israel's towns. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a covenant with us and we will serve you." They were willing to surrender, to become servants, if it meant survival. But Nahash had something else in mind, and Nahash the Ammonite answered them, "On this condition I will make a covenant with you, that I may put out all your right eyes and bring reproach on all Israel." This wasn't just about conquest, this was about humiliation. Gouging out their right eyes would disable them as warriors and mark them as defeated, bringing shame on all of Israel. Then the elders of Jabesh said to him, "Hold off for 7 days, that we may send messengers to all the territory of Israel. And then, if there is no one to save us, we will come out to you." They were asking for time, time to see if anyone in Israel would come to their rescue. So the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and told the news in the hearing of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. The news was devastating. Their fellow Israelites were about to be mutilated and enslaved, and there seemed to be nothing anyone could do about it. Now there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field. This is important. Saul was still working as a farmer. Even though he'd been anointed and proclaimed king, he was still doing ordinary work, still plowing fields and tending cattle. And Saul said, "What troubles the people that they weep?" And they told him the words of the men of Jabesh. When he heard what was happening, something changed in Saul. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard this news, and his anger was greatly aroused. This was the moment. The spirit that had come upon him when he prophesied now came upon him again, but this time for battle. His anger burned, not a sinful rage, but a righteous fury at this threat to God's people. So he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen." It was a dramatic, unmistakable call to arms. The message was clear. Join the fight or lose your livestock. This is what your oxen will look like if you don't come. And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. It wasn't just fear of Saul. It was the fear of the Lord that moved them. God was working through Saul's leadership. When he numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were 300,000 and the men of Judah 30,000. A massive army had assembled in response to Saul's call, and they said to the messengers who came, "Thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have help." Then the messengers came and reported it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Hope had arrived. Help was coming. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, "Tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do with us whatever seems good to you." They told the Ammonites they'd surrender the next day, but it was a deception to buy time, and so it was. On the next day that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch, and killed Ammonites until the heat of the day. Saul showed tactical skill, dividing his forces into three groups and attacking during the morning watch, the last watch of the night, just before dawn, when the enemy would be least prepared, and it happened that those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. It was a complete and total victory. The Ammonite army was destroyed, scattered so thoroughly that survivors couldn't even find each other. Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is he who said, 'Shall Saul reign over us?' I'll bring the men, that we may put them to death. Remember those rebels who had despised Saul and refused to bring him gifts? Now the people wanted them executed. Saul had proven himself. He'd saved Jabesh Gilead. He'd led Israel to victory. Those who had doubted him now looked like fools. But Saul said, 'Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel.' This was wisdom and mercy. Saul refused to begin his reign with executions. He gave credit to God for the victory, and he showed that he could be gracious even to those who had opposed him. The test was complete. Saul had proven himself as a military leader. The people's confidence in their king was established. Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel. 2,000 were with him in Michmash and in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. Jonathan attacked the Philistine garrison that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." Now all Israel heard it said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel had also become an abomination to the Philistines. And the people were called together to Saul at Gilgal. The Philistines gathered to fight with Israel. 1 Samuel chapter 13 verse 5 tells us they had 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. It was an enormous army. They came up and encamped in Michmash, to the east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, and in pits. Some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. He waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. This was important. Samuel had told him to wait. But Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. Every day that passed, more men deserted. Fear was spreading through the camp. The massive Philistine army was nearby, and Israel's army was melting away. So Saul said, "Bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me." And he offered the burnt offering. Saul made the decision. He performed the sacrifice himself. He took on the role of a priest, something he had no right to do. The moment he finished, Samuel arrived. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came. Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. The timing couldn't have been worse. If Saul had just waited a little longer, Samuel would have performed the sacrifice properly. But Saul hadn't waited. Samuel said, "What have you done?" It was a simple question, but it carried weight. Samuel knew exactly what Saul had done. He wanted to hear what Saul would say. Saul gave his reasons. "When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, 'The Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal.' And I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled, and offered a burnt offering, Saul laid out his logic. The army was deserting. Samuel was late. The enemy was gathering. He felt he had no choice. He felt compelled to act, but Samuel's response was harsh. You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue forever. That's what Saul lost in that moment. His kingdom could have lasted forever, passed down through his family line for generations. But now it wouldn't continue. Samuel explained why. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people. Because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you, God had already found someone else. Someone after his own heart. The replacement was already chosen, even though Saul didn't know who it was yet. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. This was significant. Samuel left. The prophet who had anointed Saul, who had stood with him, now walked away. Saul numbered the people present with him, about 600 men. That's all that remained of his army. Thousands had deserted. 600 stayed. Saul and Jonathan, his son, and the people present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin. But the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Then raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One day, Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Jonathan had faith. He said to his armor bearer, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." His armor bearer answered, "Do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you, according to your heart." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. The Philistines said, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden." Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us and we will show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel." Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him. 1 Samuel chapter 14 verse 13 says, "They fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer killed them after him." That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men, and there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchman of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away. God was giving Israel a victory, and it started with two men and their faith. Saul said to the people who were with him, "Number now and see who has gone from us." When they had numbered, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. Verse 22 says that all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day. The battle shifted beyond Beth-Aven, and the victory was spreading. But then Saul made a serious mistake. The men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening, before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. It was a rash oath. The army needed strength to pursue the enemy, but Saul had forbidden them from eating. His pride was showing, "Before I have taken vengeance on my enemies," not God's vengeance, his vengeance. Now all the people of the land came to a forest, and there was honey on the ground. When the people had come into the woods, there was the honey dripping. But no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father make this oath. He reached out the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it in a honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth. And his countenance brightened. The honey gave him strength. His eyes brightened. It refreshed him. But he'd just violated his father's oath without knowing it. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, Cursed is the man who eats food this day. And the people were faint. But Jonathan said, My father has troubled the land. Look now, how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For now would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines? Jonathan understood what his father didn't. The oath had weakened the army and limited their victory. Now they had struck down the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. So the people were very faint. The people rushed on the spoil and took sheep, oxen, and calves and slaughtered them on the ground. And the people ate them with the blood. This was a problem. The people were so hungry from the fast that they were now eating meat with blood still in it, which was forbidden. Then Saul said, Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, Bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep. Slaughter them here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So Saul built an altar to the Lord. This was the first altar that he built to the Lord. After dealing with that situation, Saul wanted to pursue the Philistines further. He said, Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. And let us not leave a man of them. The people said, Do whatever seems good to you. But the priest said, Let us draw near to God here. So Saul asked counsel of God, Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him that day. Silence. God didn't answer. This meant something was wrong. Saul said, Come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. For as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But not a man among all the people answered him. Saul was serious. Even if his own son was guilty, he would die. Then he said to all Israel, You be on one side, and my son Jonathan and I will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, Do what seems good to you. Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, Give a perfect lot. So Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, Cast lots between my son Jonathan and me. So Jonathan was taken. The lots identified Jonathan as the one who had broken the oath. Then Saul said to Jonathan, Tell me what you have done. Jonathan told him, I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. So now I must die? It was such a small thing, a taste of honey. And for this, his father was ready to kill him. Saul answered, God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. But the people said to Saul, Shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. The army intervened. They refused to let Saul execute the very man who had sparked the victory. It was a direct challenge to Saul's authority, but the people were right and Saul was wrong. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. The pursuit ended, and a greater victory was lost. Samuel said to Saul, The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore heed the voice of the words of the Lord. This was important. Samuel was reminding Saul that God had made him king. Therefore Saul needed to obey God's commands. Thus says the Lord of hosts, Samuel continued, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them. But kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. The command was crystal clear. Utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them. The list was specific. Man, woman, infant, nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, donkey. Everything was to be destroyed. This was God's judgment on the Amalekites for what they had done to Israel generations earlier. There was no room for interpretation here, no gray area, no space for Saul to decide what seemed best. God had given explicit instructions, and Saul's job was to obey them completely. So Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in Telaim. 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. It was a large army. Saul came to a city of Amalek and lay in wait in the valley. Then Saul said to the Kenites, "Go, depart, get down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. This showed Saul could make distinctions when he wanted to. He remembered the Kenites' kindness and spared them. He was capable of following specific instructions about who to spare and who not to spare. And Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. The military campaign was successful. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, but this was already a deviation from God's command. Agag was supposed to die, not be taken alive. The text in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 9 tells us clearly what happened next. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. They destroyed what seemed worthless to them and kept what seemed valuable. They substituted their own judgment for God's explicit command. God had said to destroy everything. Saul and the army decided to keep the best animals and spare the king. This was partial obedience, which is actually disobedience. Saul had won the battle but lost something far more important, God's approval. Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, "I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments." God regretted making Saul king. That's how serious this was. And it grieved Samuel. So it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. Samuel was deeply troubled by this. He spent the entire night praying, crying out to God about Saul's failure. When Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, it was told Samuel, saying, "Saul went to Carmel, and indeed, he set up a monument for himself. And he has gone on around, passed by, and gone down to Gilgal." Saul had set up a monument for himself. He was celebrating his victory, building a memorial to his own achievement, completely unaware that he had actually failed. Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." Saul greeted Samuel with confidence, even claiming he had obeyed God's command. He genuinely seemed to believe he had done what God asked. But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" It was a devastating question. "If you obeyed God's command to destroy everything," Samuel was asking, "then why do I hear sheep and cattle?" Saul's answer revealed his thinking. "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." Notice what Saul did here. First, he blamed the people. They brought them. The people spared them. Second, he tried to make it sound religious. They kept them to sacrifice to the Lord. And third, he called God your God instead of our God, and creating distance between himself and the Lord. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said to him, "Speak on." Samuel reminded him, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" Samuel laid out the facts. God gave clear instructions. Saul didn't follow them. Instead, he took plunder for himself. Saul still tried to defend himself. "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I've utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. He was still blaming the people, still claiming the animals were for sacrifice, still calling God your God instead of owning his relationship with the Lord. Then Samuel spoke words that would echo through history. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. This was the heart of the matter. Saul thought he could cover his disobedience with religious activity, but God wanted obedience, not excuses wrapped in spirituality. Samuel continued, "For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. Rebellion like witchcraft, stubbornness like idolatry." These were strong words, and the verdict was final. God had rejected Saul from being king. Then Saul said to Samuel, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice." Finally, Saul admitted he sinned, but even in his confession, he was still making excuses. "I feared the people and obeyed their voice." He was still blaming others. "Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord." But Samuel said to Saul, "I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel." The rejection was final. Samuel turned to leave, and as Samuel turned around to go away, Saul seized the edge of his robe and it tore. In that moment, something physical happened that carried spiritual meaning. So Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. And also the strength of Israel will not lie nor relent. For he is not a man that he should relent." The torn robe became a prophetic sign. Just as the robe was torn from Samuel, so the kingdom was torn from Saul, and it was given to someone else, someone better than Saul. Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Yet honor me now, please, before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return with me, that I may worship the Lord your God." Even in this moment, Saul was concerned about appearances. He wanted to be honored before the people. He wanted Samuel to come back with him so he'd look good publicly. So Samuel turned back after Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. Then Samuel said, "Bring Agag, king of the Amalekites, here to me." So Agag came to him cautiously, and Agag said, "Surely the bitterness of death is past." But Samuel said, "As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women." And Samuel hacked Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. Samuel finished the job Saul should have done. He executed God's judgment on Agag himself. Then Samuel went to Ramah, and Saul went up to his house at Gibeah of Saul. And Samuel went no more to see Saul until the day of his death. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. The relationship was over. Samuel never saw Saul again while Saul lived. The prophet mourned for the king, grieving over what could have been. And God regretted making Saul king, the man who had started with such promise, anointed by God and empowered by his spirit, had now been rejected and replaced. But the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. This was the consequence of God's rejection. The same spirit that had come upon Saul when he was anointed, the spirit that had empowered him to prophesy and lead, that spirit was gone, and in its place came something dark and tormenting. 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 15 tells us that Saul's servants said to him, "Surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you. Let our master now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp, and it shall be that he will play it with his hand when the distressing spirit from God is upon you, and you shall be well." The servants could see what was happening to their king. These episodes of darkness, these moments when Saul couldn't function normally, they suggested music as a remedy, a skilled harpist whose playing might calm the king's troubled mind. So Saul said to his servants, "Provide me now a man who can play well and bring him to me." Then one of the servants answered and said, "Look, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech and a handsome person. And the Lord is with him." The description was impressive. This young man had multiple qualities: musical skill, courage, military ability, wisdom in speaking, good looks. But the most important detail was saved for last. The Lord is with him. The Lord was with David. The Lord had departed from Saul, and now Saul was about to bring David into his service, completely unaware that this young musician was the very person God had chosen to replace him. Therefore, Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the sheep." And Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread, a skin of wine, and a young goat, and sent them by his son David to Saul. So David came to Saul and stood before him. And he loved him greatly, and he became his armor-bearer. Then Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Please let David stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight." Saul loved him. He didn't know David would take his kingdom. He just knew that this young man brought him relief. And so it was, whenever the Spirit from God was upon Saul, that David would take a harp and play it with his hand. Then Saul would become refreshed and well, and the distressing spirit would depart from him. The music worked. David's playing brought temporary peace to Saul's tormented mind. But this solution wouldn't last forever. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle. David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. But one day, Jesse sent David to check on his brothers who were with Saul's army. When David arrived at the camp, he heard Goliath's challenge. The giant was defying Israel, and no one would face him. David volunteered. He told Saul about killing a lion and a bear while protecting his father's sheep, and said the Lord who delivered him from the paw of the lion and the bear would deliver him from this Philistine. Saul let him go. David took 5 smooth stones from the brook, his sling in his hand, and approached Goliath. The Philistine cursed David by his gods, but David said to him, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." David ran toward the Philistine. He slung a stone, and it sank into Goliath's forehead. The giant fell face down on the ground. David took Goliath's own sword and killed him, then cut off his head. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Israel pursued them and won a great victory. Now it happened as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. The celebration was massive. The women were singing and dancing. But then came the words that changed everything. So the women sang as they danced and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 8 tells us, "Then Saul was very angry and the saying displeased him. And he said, 'They have ascribed to David 10,000s and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?'" Saul heard the comparison and immediately understood the threat. If David had tens of thousands and he had only thousands, what was next? The kingdom itself. So Saul eyed David from that day forward, and it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times. But there was a spear in Saul's hand. David was doing what he always did, playing the harp to calm the king. But this time Saul had a spear, and Saul cast the spear, for he said, "I will pin David to the wall." But David escaped his presence twice. Twice Saul threw the spear at David, trying to kill him. Twice David dodged it. The man who had brought Saul relief was now the target of his violence. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. This was the root of Saul's fear. He could see that God was with David. He knew God had left him, and that terrified him more than anything else. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. Saul thought he could get David killed in battle by putting him in dangerous positions. But the plan backfired, and David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. Everything Saul tried only made David more popular and more successful. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." This was another scheme. Saul offered his daughter as a bride price that would require David to fight dangerous battles. Saul hoped the Philistines would kill David for him, but when the time came for Merab to be given to David, she was given to another man instead. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, "I will give her to him, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Saul saw another opportunity. His younger daughter loved David, so he'd use her love as a trap. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, "You shall be my son-in-law today." And Saul commanded his servants, "Communicate with David secretly and say, 'Look, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law.'" When David said he was too poor to become the king's son-in-law, Saul's servants told him, "In this manner the king desires no dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies." It was a deadly bride price. Saul hoped David would die trying to collect it. Therefore David arose and went, he and his men, and killed 200 men of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full count to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as a wife. David didn't just meet the requirement, he doubled it. 200 instead of 100. Thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul became David's enemy continually. Every scheme failed. Every trap backfired. David kept succeeding, and Saul's fear kept growing. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. The secret plots were over. Saul was now openly ordering David's death, but Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide." Jonathan had become David's closest friend. He warned David and then went to plead with his father. And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord accomplished a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?" It was a powerful appeal. Jonathan reminded his father of David's loyalty, his courage against Goliath, and the victory God gave through him. So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." Saul took an oath. David would not be killed. Jonathan brought David back to Saul, and David was in his presence as in times past. But the peace didn't last, and there was war again. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. David's success triggered Saul's jealousy again. Now the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing music with his hand. The scene was repeating. David playing music, Saul holding a spear, the tormenting spirit upon the king. Then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. The oath was broken. Despite swearing before the Lord, Saul had tried to kill David again. Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." Michal, Saul's own daughter, helped David escape. So Michal let David down through a window. And he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, put a cover of goat's hair for his head, and covered it with clothes. This was a decoy to buy David time. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." When they came and found only the image in the bed, Saul was furious. But David was already gone. And David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. So he and Samuel went and stayed in Naioth. David sought refuge with the prophet. He was now officially a fugitive, running for his life from the king he had served faithfully. Now it was told Saul, saying, "Take note, David is at Naioth in Ramah." Saul knew where David was. He sent soldiers to capture him. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. The soldiers never completed their mission. When they approached the prophets, God's Spirit came upon them, and they began prophesying instead. And when Saul was told, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. Then Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. It kept happening. Three groups of soldiers. Three times they began prophesying instead of capturing David. God was creating a supernatural barrier around David that Saul's men couldn't cross. Then he went there to Naioth in Ramah. Then the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naioth in Ramah. Even Saul himself wasn't immune. The Spirit of God came upon the king, just as it had come upon his messengers, and he also stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore they say, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" It was the same saying from years earlier, but now it meant something different. The first time it marked Saul's transformation and anointing. This time it marked his humiliation. He lay there prophesying, unable to harm David, unable to complete his murderous mission. God had protected David in the most dramatic way possible. Saul couldn't touch him. Then Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day." Saul's paranoia had grown. He accused his own servants of conspiracy. He believed everyone was against him, plotting with David. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." Doeg reported what he had seen. The priest Ahimelech had helped David, so the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house. The priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king. Saul summoned not just Ahimelech, but the entire priestly family. And Saul said, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." He answered, "Here I am, my lord." Then Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day?" Saul was accusing the priest of treason. So Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father. For your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much. Ahimelech's defense was solid. David was the king's son-in-law, a trusted captain, honorable in Saul's house. The priest had no reason to think David was a fugitive, but Saul didn't care. And the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." The death sentence was pronounced, not just on Ahimelech, but on his entire family. Then the king said to the guards who stood about him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me." But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. Saul's own guards refused. They wouldn't kill the Lord's priests. These were holy men, servants of God. The guards had more fear of the Lord than fear of Saul. And the king said to Doeg, "You turn and kill the priests." So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. Doeg had no such hesitation. 85 priests were slaughtered. Also Nob, the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword. Both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys and sheep, with the edge of the sword. The massacre extended beyond the priests. Doeg went to their city and killed everyone. Men, women, children, infants. He killed the livestock too. It was complete destruction. The kind of destruction Saul should have carried out against the Amalekites, but didn't. Now he was doing it to God's own priests. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. Only one survived to tell what happened. So David said to Abiathar, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul. I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house." David felt responsible. His visit to Nob had led to this massacre. He told Abiathar, "Stay with me. Do not fear. For he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe." Then they told David, saying, "Look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah, and they are robbing the threshing floors." David inquired of the Lord and saved the city. But when Saul heard that David was a Keilah, he came after him. David learned that Saul was plotting against him, so he left Keilah. David stayed in strongholds in the wilderness. 1 Samuel chapter 23 verse 14 says, "And Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. The pursuit continued. Day after day, Saul hunted David, but God protected David. Then Saul went to seek David in the wilderness of En-Gedi, and he took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. 3,000 soldiers. Saul was determined to find David, so he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. The irony was stunning. Saul entered the very cave where David was hiding, completely unaware. Then the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" David's men saw this as divine opportunity. God had delivered Saul into their hands. They urged David to kill him, and David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. David crept close enough to cut Saul's robe, but even that small act bothered his conscience, and he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. David refused to harm God's anointed king, even though Saul was trying to kill him. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. David also arose afterward, went out of the cave and called out to Saul, saying, "My lord the king." After Saul left the cave and walked away, David came out and called to him. And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your harm'? Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you. But my eye spared you, and I said, 'I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' Moreover, my father, see? Yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you. Know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you. Yet you hunt my life to take it." David showed him the piece of robe, proof that he could have killed Saul but chose not to. So it was, when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, that Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Saul broke down. Then he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me. For when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me." Saul admitted David's righteousness. He acknowledged that David had treated him better than he deserved. Then Saul said, "I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand." Saul knew. He knew David would be king. He knew he'd lost, and Saul went home. But David and his men went up to the stronghold. This moment of clarity didn't change anything. The pursuit would continue. Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had lamented for him and buried him in Ramah, in his own city. And Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land. The prophet was dead. Saul had also removed all those who practiced dark spiritual arts. Then the Philistines gathered together and came and encamped at Shunem. So Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. The Philistine army was massive, and Saul was terrified. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets. Saul tried to get guidance from God. Dreams, nothing. The sacred lots, nothing. The prophets, nothing. God was silent. Then Saul said to his servants, "Find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servants said to him, "In fact, there is a woman who is a medium at En-Dor." In his desperation, Saul decided to do what he himself had forbidden. He would consult a medium. So Saul disguised himself and put on other clothes, and he went, and two men with him. And they came to the woman by night, and he said, "Please conduct a seance for me, and bring up for me the one I shall name to you." Then the woman said to him, "Look, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the spiritists from the land. Why then do you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die?" The woman was afraid it was a trap. But Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, "As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." The irony was thick. Saul swore by the Lord while seeking forbidden spiritual contact. Then the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" And he said, "Bring up Samuel for me." Saul wanted to speak with the dead prophet. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, "Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul." She recognized him. And the king said to her, "Do not be afraid. What did you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth." So he said to her, "What is his form?" And she said, "An old man is coming up, and he is covered with a mantle." And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. And he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed down. Now Samuel said to Saul,
"Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?"
Even in this supernatural encounter, Samuel's words were harsh, and Saul answered, "I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me any more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called you, that you may reveal to me what I should do." Saul admitted his situation. God had departed from him. No one would answer him. He was desperate. Then Samuel said, "So why do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me. For the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore, the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. The prophecy was devastating. Saul would die tomorrow. His sons would die. Israel would be defeated. Samuel was announcing Saul's death sentence. Immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day or all night. Saul collapsed, terrified and weak from fasting. The woman urged him to eat something. His servants also urged him, and he heeded their voice. So they brought him food, and he ate. Then they rose and went away that night. Saul left to face his final battle. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. Jonathan was dead. Saul's other sons were dead. Samuel's prophecy was coming true. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Saul's armor-bearer refused to kill the king. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. Saul killed himself. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor-bearer, and all his men died together that same day. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim it in the temple of their idols and among the people. Then they put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan. This was the end. The man God had chosen, anointed, and empowered, the man who stood head and shoulders above everyone else, died by his own hand on a battlefield. His body was displayed on an enemy wall. His armor hung in a pagan temple. The spirit had departed. The kingdom was torn away, and Saul's tragic reign was over.